Welcome to Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary. Hello and welcome to Working the Lectionary, a podcast in which the world of work is examined through readings from the weekly lectionary. My name is Brendan Byrne, and I am one of the co-hosts, and with me is my fellow host, John Bottomley. John, hello and welcome.
Hi there, Brendan. Good to see you again.
Good to have you here with us, and in this episode we will be examining readings for the second and third Sundays in the season of Easter, and to that end we hope our listeners experienced a meaningful journey over Holy Week from the Last Supper through the tragedy of Good Friday and into the joyous news of the empty tomb on Easter Sunday. But now in this post-Easter season, we come as it were to the aftermath, to the question of what comes next. And we begin our answer to that question with a reading from the second Sunday in Easter, which comes from the Gospel according to John, chapter 20, verses 19 to 31. A reading from the Gospel according to John, chapter 20, verses 19 to 31. When it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and the doors of the house where the disciples had met were locked for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord. Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he had said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." But Thomas, who was called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the mark of the nails in his hands, and put my finger in the mark of the nails in his side, I will not believe." A week later his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. Although the doors were shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here and see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing you may have life in his name. This is a passage in which modernity has a good deal of difficulty, not least because of what seems to be the supernatural elements within the narrative. And yet, at another level, this passage, ironically, it seems to me, fits in rather neatly with the zeitgeist of modernity, inasmuch as it articulates an ideology of "I'll only believe what I see." That's the hallmark of modern scientism, an ideology that pretends to the skepticism and analytical objectivity of the scientific method, but which in truth is an idol as insistent on unchallenged belief as the religious faith it accuses of credulity and superstition. Yet if we go beyond this superficial level, we are able to discern the two key themes in this passage. Firstly, that Jesus is the Son of God, and secondly, that Jesus makes himself known in an active, interpersonal way that enables a new form of life. And yet Thomas' disbelief at the disciples' reports of the resurrection leads not to condemnation, but to an invitation, to belief in the possibility of a new way of being, of a new form of relationship between God and humankind that invites human beings to reconstruct their relationships with one another in a similarly new way. John, I'm curious to know what you make of Thomas' disbelief with its exaggerated realism, and how this attitude is reflected by modern-day proponents of capitalism's ethic of greed and their insistence that there is no other way except to keep endlessly repeating what we're doing right now.
You pinpointed Thomas's realism.
Mm.
And to understand a bit more of that, you really need to understand that John's not one for mentioning lots of people by name.
Mm.
And Thomas is one of the select few, and this is the third reference to Thomas. So the first encounter is when Jesus tells the disciples he's going to Lazarus's tomb, and the disciples express their anxiety about that because that means he's going back to, you know, the centre of opposition to him and potentially facing his death again. And Thomas sort of says, well, let's all go, you know, I'll go with him. Let's all go with him. And there's actually a sense of what I think of bravado about this realism, you know, like a little bit Trumpian in a sense, you know, like Trump saying he wouldn't mind being martyred. Make him more famous. There's a sort of a sense of what's Thomas really thinking here, that he's going to be a bit of a hero here by going. But the acid test is, of course, when Jesus is actually arrested. And Thomas is nowhere to be seen, along with all the other disciples. So the realism, in a way, you know, is exposed as being quite shallow.
Yes.
And the reality of violence is not something that we choose to step into with any sort of bravado. So to me, what that sort of highlights is that because scientism, you know, that is so preoccupied with what can be seen and what can be measured, that it doesn't see Thomas's inner turmoil, both in why was he sort of so sort of hyper aggressive in a way about going with Jesus to the to his death when he actually wasn't, and then why are they hiding, you know, all the disciples, they actually only get together in a locked room to lock out the Jews. Well, who are the Jews? They're the Jews. They're the people who handed Jesus over for crucifixion. So if you were close to Jesus, you'd have a thought that maybe you're next in line, you know, if they want to stamp out this sort of movement. So what John is sort of drawing our attention to here is that the inner life, if you like, of humankind, of each human. And Thomas's inner life is actually frightened. Not just of the Jews, but he's actually frightened of Jesus, because he knows he's made this brash promise, and he didn't go anywhere near it. So how's he going to confront him? So John sets this up by having Thomas absent when Jesus comes and forgives them all, and I think that's what Thomas can't believe. How can somebody who's been so brutally betrayed forgive me, who's been such an imposter?
Yes.
And that's what we don't see in the Royal Commission into Banking.
Yes.
So we've got these sort of CEOs and board members spouting off to the commissioner near the end of the inquiry about all the wonderful things they're going to do to reform their banks and to bring integrity back, and there'll be no more misconduct and blah, blah, blah. But what we've seen in the, nearly 3 years since the end of the Royal Commission is nothing of the sort.
Yes.
The inner spirit of the banks is still maximising profit. And in fact, in the pandemic and now in this post-pandemic scene, the banks are amongst the corporations in Australia that have maximised their profitability.
Yes, yes.
So we don't need to go too far to see how poignant this gospel passage is in relation to the operation of capitalist sort of ethics. Capitalist ethics are still on about maximising profit. That's the highest virtue. And they hide it. It's hidden. And it's hidden because at their heart they know that it's unjust, to my mind. So what's happening here is that Thomas's sort of duplicity is exposed, and in his shame, he has got nothing to offer.
Mm.
But Jesus comes to him despite all of that. So John makes the point of telling the same story a second time, but this time Thomas is in the room.
Mm.
And to my mind, he's humbled by the fact that Jesus invites him to that very intimate touch of the body.
Mm.
And that's what does him in. And he collapses.
Mm.
He falls on the floor. This is an act of devotion. Mm. And his words, "My Lord and my God." So he actually adds something to the other declarations of the disciples who have all, those who've seen the resurrected Christ recognize him as the Lord.
Mm.
Thomas says, "My Lord and my God."
Mm.
And both of these terms are in the contested space of the claims of the emperor.
Yes.
Because the emperor, from Caesar on, have claimed to be Son of God.
Yes.
And Lord.
Yes.
Over all.
Yes.
So John has Thomas stating that in Thomas, the disciples are a counter movement to the Roman Imperium. And what that sort of says, I think, is the importance, for example, of protections for whistleblowers.
Yes.
How do we protect? Because the Royal Commission into the banking industry would not have happened without whistleblowers in the Commonwealth Bank, two in particular, who both lost their jobs.
Yes.
Over their disclosures.
Yes.
Of what they saw as corruption.
Yes.
So capitalism works to stamp out whistleblowers.
Yes.
The governments around Australia have been complicit in not doing it enough to protect whistleblowers and to allow capitalism that sort of freedom, so-called, muzzle people.
Mm.
And so I think this passage speaks deeply into the need for integrity in work relations that allow the truth to be spoken without fear or favour.
Mm.
And that phrase in itself just reminds me of where we're up to with robo-debt.
Mm.
And the surprising thing is that no one can remember what's in their hearts in the witnesses who've been complicit.
Yes.
So the commission's effectively forced to rely on email trials and statements that have been made, the sort of objective evidence.
Yes.
But the interior spirit, these people are desperately trying to cover up their shame and their guilt.
Yes.
And I think that's where Thomas's story brings us to the point that, that the road to of shame and guilt has no end.
Mm.
Sorry, it has an end in abject failure. There is no humanity there.
Yeah, and I'm interested in what you were saying earlier about how Thomas's bravado belies his inner reality of fear and shame and guilt.
Mm.
Because it seems to me, from my own experience in the corporate world, that, and indeed in the church, that the construction of corporations and the church as an institution requires people to assume this persona of bravado, of self-promotion, of publicity seeking, of attention seeking, that denies their inner humanity, that is fearful, that is scared of being exposed, of making mistakes, and is scared of being held up for ridicule, and of not upholding the modern mythology of the autonomous individual. And I think we see that also in the political culture, where politicians are not allowed to make mistakes. And where our election campaigns are obsessed with the gaffe and gotcha questions and catching people out. How does this reading speak to modernity's myth of the autonomous individual and its hiding of the vulnerable human reality beneath, and where does it provide hope in that space?
So Thomas, in a way, is every man. So in his second appearance in John, he's trying to find out from Jesus in this final discourse, you know, what's going to happen to Jesus. And Thomas is more or less says, well, you haven't told us where you're going, so how can we know the way? But John's one of John's sort of strategies, if you like, is to always have the disciples asking off questions. They're always a bit off.
Yeah.
And then Jesus comes back with, I am the way, the truth.
Yes.
And the life type of thing. So it sets up that. So what does that mean? It basically means that in modernity, the promise is always empty.
Mm.
And the sense that we can sort of save ourselves proves to be a dead end.
Yes.
So I sort of would recall in my earliest years of ministry, or not even earliest, but probably moving into 20 years of ministry, that I used to pride myself in being a sort of a cutting edge minister, you know, and liberation theology and the rhetoric around what I saw my ministry as always carried this sort of self-congratulatory sort of I'm out there committed to liberation issues. And I think it was probably around the time of my experience of open heart surgery that sort of reality sort of came crashing down. And I discovered, you know, that in intensive care after having 7 or 8 hours of surgery to repair a faulty valve I was born with, heart valve, that I had nothing to save myself, and I was dependent on the mercy of God and the kindness of the nursing staff and the competence of the surgeons. I think that's where I see myself in Thomas's shoes, that Thomas is actually in that room in despair, got nothing to really do to help himself. And Jesus comes to him. And if I was to sort of say, I think modernity's got caught up in it. We can save ourselves, and mission's the buzzword. So if we keep focusing on our mission, somehow we'll find the answer to our declining congregations or our lostness in the cultural wars or whatever it happens to be. And we need this sort of transformative moment of acknowledging that unless we're open to Jesus coming to us with a word of forgiveness, and we hear that word of forgiveness, we can't be born again in that sort of sense that John talks about it with Nicodemus, that the opportunity to be born into a new reality is a gift of God's grace, and it creates a relationship. And what that means in a way for the world of work is the possibility that work can be a co-creative activity if we understood what God was calling us to. And we're not being called to feather our own nests or to parade our own virtues. We're actually called to something far more humble, to point to who is Lord and who is God in the midst of the complexities of work. And that is something that the church is poorly equipped for because we really don't know how to speak into the world of work very well. And they're pastoral conversations and they are political conversations at the same time.
Yes. And on that very point of the church's inability to speak into the world of work, it seems to me that the church is doing a lot of compensating for that by projecting its activity in other areas of social justice activity as a kind of promotional cover for its inability to speak into the world of work, into the reality of work in modernity.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that's, in a sense, the sort of exegesis of Thomas's second experience. It's essentially, you can read it as being sarcastic, which was almost my default position dealing with uncertainty, is to actually have a throwaway sarcastic line, a little bit tinged with irony perhaps, but pushing people away. And so we've got all these different sort of mechanisms for dehumanising uncomfortable situations, keeping people at a distance. And I think the power of the gospel story here is that Jesus can absorb all that.
Yes.
And because the grace that's with him is larger than our sort of petty fears, if you like. I mean, they're real and quite disabling as Thomas experiences it, but Jesus just goes in a phrase I think that's probably quite alive in the referendum sort of context. Jesus goes to the heart. And he speaks to the heart of Thomas's fear. I mean, one of the things that people say about work as a criticism is it's soul-destroying, you know. And I think that you could say that when people say that, they're saying that their workplace has no heart. And it actually then gives away that what people are looking for there, because Jesus comes with such a full heart that it's transformative.
And I think last night, in fact, I witnessed an example of that. I watch a television series called The Circus, which is an American political documentary series that began back with the Trump campaign that won him the presidency, and it has continued year by year since then. And it was talking about the present lawsuit that has been launched against the Fox Media organization by that Dominion company that manufactures the voting machines, which Trump and others alleged were rigged. And the Fox organization gave a lot of airtime to that, even though its various presenters have been shown through emails and other documents that they didn't believe the accusations, and in fact found the people pushing these accusations painful to deal with, etc. But they still pushed it because, in many ways, Fox, which is widely regarded as one of the most powerful media organizations on the planet, is in fact captive to the prejudices of its audience. And through the course of this episode of this show last night, as this was being explored, one of the reporters engaged in a lapse of judgment that enabled Fox to then complain that they were being dealt with prejudicially. And there was quite a moving moment at the end of the episode where the reporting team gathered, and the reporter in question clearly owned their mistake and their lapse of judgment. And the other reporters said clearly, you know, this is not what we're about, and this was a bad mistake and a bad lapse of judgment to have made. And you could clearly see the regret on this reporter's face. And yet the very fact that they included this in the episode about Fox, when a network like Fox not only would not do that, but is in fact contesting this legal claim, that to me struck me as a very Thomas moment of grace with Jesus. So it's still possible, even in the midst of the dehumanizing reality of modernity, to have those moments of grace.
Yes, yes. And I think that's how John sort of sums up the chapter. The story of Thomas is actually, NRSV calls this last couple of verses the purpose of the book. And the purpose of the book is that you may come to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, that is the Lord, the Son of God. And the belief is not, the seeing is believing so much as seeing what's at the heart of life is where belief comes from. So Thomas's belief is in Jesus as his saviour, not in a conceptual or intellectual sense, but actually as the one who rescues him from the burden of his sin, of his betrayal, of his fear, of his persona, and he's reborn in a way into a new relationship. And our problem in a way in modernity is that we've mistranslated belief as intellectual assent, rather than as trust in the mystery of love. And this is the essence of what God is about, to show us what love has to do with the valuing of life. So, I mean, Thomas is probably expecting Jesus to give him the flick. But in fact, he's embraced and brought into the fold, and he's restored in solidarity with God and with the community of Jesus' followers. And somehow that's sort of so countercultural, it's sort of unrealistic in modernity's terms. So what's been interesting at in some of the debates that are going on at the moment is around the AUKUS decision and the purchase of submarines. The mantra is really is we have to be realistic. We have to be realistic. John's gospel is not at all interested in being realistic. On the basis of realism, Thomas is dead meat.
Yeah.
Who'd want him in your team? And so it sort of calls forth a bit of a hermeneutic of suspicion, I suppose, that everything's not what it seems on the surface.
That
John wants us to sort of be discerning and attentive to the sort of inner movements of the Spirit that may not be obvious in the midst of violence and death, but that's where God's at work when the world can no longer even bear to look.
So where then is the restoration? Where then is the solidarity that Thomas experiences for those two whistleblowers you mentioned earlier who lost their job? Particularly when one considers that the CEO of that bank gave sworn evidence in the commission that he and his predecessor had a conversation in which they acknowledged that a particular insurance product the bank was selling was worthless, and yet in which they agreed to continue selling the product. And this CEO is still in office, still drawing their exorbitant wage. And as far as I'm aware, there haven't even been any recommendations that this individual and their predecessor be investigated, let alone prosecuted, for any potential violations under trade law or corporations law or anything like that. So for those two whistleblowers who lost their jobs, where's the restorative power of this reading for them?
Well, I think that's a challenging question, because I've had contact with one of them, and he's lost his marriage and as well as his job as a result of his whistleblowing. But he is in demand in speaking to people who are concerned about whether or not they should be whistleblowing. And he's indicated an interest in being part of the religion and social policy response to providing professional ethics training for people in the industry to give people advice on whether or not they might consider being a whistleblower. In part, I would say, from my point of view, I mean, my hope would be that people turn towards these men with a sense of grace and seek to provide them with opportunities for fulfillment of life. Whether that's happening, I'm not sure. I haven't talked to them, and I've spoken with now for nearly a year with the various COVID restrictions and my own issues, but it would be sort of duplicitous, if you like, to sort of make some sort of Pollyanna sort of statement that they've got a new beginning or a new possibility, because I know from our work on suicide that capitalism crushes more people. And so to my mind, I think it's probably more important to hold on to the question that you've asked than to have an answer at the moment, because I think the question itself should drive people who are concerned about justice at work to not forget those who've been marginalised by the machinations of the capitalist sort of idolatry of profit-making. And that's really one of the depressing things about modern politics, with the focus on being real and realistic. Those who are sort of collateral damage of how you got to being realistic just get cast aside. And I think that's unconscionable. So for you to ask the question, I think, means that it's an uncomfortable question which we should be willing to hold in front of us.
So then, preaching on this text into the world of work, what's the key message for preachers?
I think the key message is not to swallow the sort of ideological rhetoric of the business world that they live in, and to be attuned to the underlying reality of shame and guilt, which is so well hidden, and to be open to that when church members are conscious of their own struggles, that they bring those sort of things prayerfully to Christ and invite his sort of lordship over their life to sort of let go. People, preachers should be encouraging people to let go of the ideologies that are crushing the life out of others and not to be judging people, you know, in their Thomas-like bravado or their Thomas-like sort of denial. These are all human things that John readily incorporates into the story. And I'm a great one for sort of looking at not the first incident as an accident and the second incident as coincidence and the third incident as that's the one that points you to where you might really need to have a very close look at what's going on. And I think that's what John is doing here with Thomas.
Yep.
We get the three stories because we can identify the first incident and the second in our accommodation or our complicity in the the world of work and sort of capitalist, modernist sort of ethos of how to be human. But it's in the third when Thomas is absolutely broken by his confrontation or by Jesus' confrontation with him that he suddenly sees the possibilities for a new beginning that's refocused on the importance of God's love in his life.
Well, I think on that note, it's time now that we move to our reading for Easter 3, which comes from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 34, verses 13 to 35.
A reading from the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 24, verses 13 to 35. Now, on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked of them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find the body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels who said that he was alive. Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it, just as the women had said, but they did not see him." Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road, and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
This passage is the
Welcome to Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary.
Story of a journey in which, in the aftermath of Jesus' crucifixion, the disciples are all broken and defeated by their trauma. They have refused to believe the early reports from the women who found the empty tomb that Jesus has risen and are huddled together behind locked doors, a community not of hope but of fear and despair. Some of Jesus' followers are even so terrified that they run away from Jerusalem, eager to put as much distance between themselves and the vengeful authorities who crucified Jesus. Yet even in this instance, Jesus moves into their presence, even though they are unable to recognize him. And in a series of seemingly innocuous questions, he listens to their downheartedness, as indeed they reveal the brokenness of their hearts to him. As evening approaches, they offer Jesus hospitality, but in an ironic twist, the roles are reversed in the act of breaking and blessing bread, and Jesus becomes host and provider to them. He makes himself known to them even as he disappears from their sight. And such is the power of that revelation of presence that the disciples immediately return to Jerusalem and to the disciple group, to become a restored community of solidarity and grace. John, you spent 30 plus years ministering to people bereaved and broken and dehumanized by the betrayed promises of capitalism, by the oppressive regulatory and judicial processes that were supposed to protect them, and by the social stigmas that denied them fellowship and solidarity. How does this passage relate to and even mirror your own experience of journeying with those who suffered? And how did that companionship become a source of you being hosted and afforded grace?
I think that when we established a program to provide grief support to families bereaved by work-related death, my pastoral sort of heart, as it were, really was responding to what I knew about grief and how to support people in their grief. But in the end, that wasn't really adequate, because the grief is a response to something prior to that. And what's prior to it is an act of violence. And I really didn't... I think I grew up frightened of violence, frightened of conflict. And so, in a way, attending to grief was partly a denial as a pastoral response. And that's, I think that's where the church is at largely in our pastoral ministry today. We find it really hard to sit with the impact of violence on people's lives, because it actually destroys, it kills people, and it destroys those who are their loved ones. And particularly suicide deaths and work-related suicide brings all the hopes of capitalism crashing down. You know, that someone could go to work and be bullied or be abused or made redundant, and the meaning of their life just disappears, falls away, and they take their life. So one of the things that I learned was that not to speak too quickly and not to about grief, and to pay attention to the reality of violence. And as you listen to the violence, you heard what I will call the trauma symptoms. So I think trauma is a symptom, but violence is the cause. And if we treat the symptoms as the cause of people's unhappiness, then we're not dealing with the issue. So what this text does is it acknowledges that these two disciples were getting out of Jerusalem. So it wasn't because they wanted to go for a walk to Emmaus, because of Emmaus's great holiday reputation. They wanted to get away from Jerusalem for the same reason that a whole lot of people wanted to move out of the cities during the pandemic and live in regional and rural Australia. People want to get away from the harm, or where they perceive the harm to be most virulent. So there's a truth speaking here, that urban life or city life or life in Jerusalem, with all of its promise, of the temple and the political elite was the greatest threat to their well-being. So they're on the road, they get away. And then they couldn't see, right? They didn't, this stranger walks up alongside them and they don't know who it is. And so there's this sort of belief that I've also had that you have to ask the grieving person what they need. And then you respond to what they need. But this story tells you they don't know what they need.
Yes.
And if you get if your pastoral ministry is about helping bereaved people to tell you what they need so you can help, then you're just sort of leaving them further isolated because it shows you're not really willing to listen to their underlying grief, their pain, their sort of sense of despair. And I like the fact that Jesus, with his silence, invites, you know, well, you're the only one around here who doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And he says, oh, you better tell me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he doesn't set out to justify himself and, no, I'm here to help. Any of that. And so the story tumbles out. And I think that the challenge of listening to somebody is often a challenge of hearing the story and hearing it again. And allowing it to sort of tumble out in whatever way it can be told. And I remember interviewing a woman for a project we did on work factors in grief, and her son, who was an apprentice, had committed suicide. And I was interviewing her for her story to be included in a report. And at the end of it, she said, "You're the first person who's let me tell my whole story." So she had people want to know it. You know, the doctor wants to know a bit of it, or somebody else wants to know another bit of it, but nobody's given the time, which is can be a lengthy time. So that if Emmaus is 6 miles or 6K, whatever it is, it's a good journey.
Yeah.
So there's plenty of time to hear, and they do.
Yeah.
I think that's important. Then I think the other thing that was very prominent for me as a parish minister is that the church had to be hospitable, and there was a lot of talk even back in the late 70s and 80s about making your building more hospitable, which might involve having an overhead projector or coffee after the service so on and so on. And so I was imbued with that. But when I went to work at the Williamstown Naval Dockyard as a researcher, I've told you my experience before, and I think at the beginning of the podcast series, but sitting down for morning tea with a union delegate, and because I'd come late, I didn't have any morning tea with me, and so he asked whether I'd like some, and I was a bit embarrassed that I was going to be taking his morning tea, and I was just about to say no, and I said, "Yes, please." He took out his salada cracker sandwich, and he just held it in front of me and broke it, and offered me piece, and it was in the breaking of the bread, the breaking of the sandwich, that I remembered this story, and I remembered that I was being invited into his world, and that changed my whole pastoral perspective on hospitality, that Jesus is always the host, and even though we might think that we're being hospitable inviting Jesus into our space, unless we hear Jesus inviting us into the grace of God, then the movement that we need to make doesn't happen. And so now when I'm listening to somebody, I'm very conscious that they're inviting me to listen to their story. They're inviting me into their world, and I need to be able to attend to what their world is. And of course, coming from a middle class background and a professional education, here I am in a blue-collar workforce amongst the steel and concrete of a shipbuilding yard, men in overalls. It was a whole new world, and this union delegate invited me into his world, and it was such a gift. And it attuned my ear to that world. And I think, again, this is where the church doesn't do a good service to our members, because we don't spend much time listening to their world of work, and how they may be hosting Jesus for us if we opened our ears and opened our eyes. So all that's going on here, and the opportunity to to know Jesus, of course, is the point that you made earlier, that this is not learning something about Jesus. This is Jesus disclosing who God is for them, and it sets the whole movement off on a new direction. And that's what happened. So for me to come out of that experience at the dockyard and with a commitment to workplace sort of ministry, and then along the way with bereaved people, because I learnt to listen to them more and more as the host and to enter their world, the program that we developed had what I, or what the agency ended up identifying as a sort of pastoral companioning model, that we were there to walk alongside in very much the sort of Emmaus journey model, and to be attentive to the opportunities to see where God was at work and to affirm those. And I don't think there's more that can be said than the number of people who went through the program who went on to work in bereavement support in different areas, whether it was disabilities or with work, or whether it was suicide, that these people found in the program a sense of the Spirit of God that gave them courage to reach out and be able to minister to others in different spheres.
I must confess to having a slightly hidden agenda, John, because I was hoping you were going to mention that story your experience in the dockyards, because it segues rather nicely to a famous painting by Rembrandt of the Emmaus event. And Jesus and the two disciples are in the foreground, and Jesus and Rembrandt captures that moment of revelation, and you see the startled look on the face of the two disciples. But the thing is, outside this circle of light that images that moment of revelation, the whole room at the inn is dark. Except in the background, there's another circle of light illuminating a serving woman whose back is turned to the scene, but whose light is nonetheless illuminated. And it's almost as though the light from Jesus' revelation has leapt across the dark and captured this humble, lowly serving woman.
Yeah.
And there's a corresponding painting by Velázquez, which is actually painted from the point of view of the woman.
Mm-hmm.
We see Jesus and that moment of revelation in the background, but Velázquez captures the serving woman almost as though she's looking over her shoulder, having been struck by some force, some energy that has captured her.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, from that moment of revelation for you in that shipyard, whether and in this reading, whether or not this speaks to how often the church itself has been captured by the modern desire, the modern demand for answers. And you walk into any bookstore and there are shelves of self-help books and how to make your life better and how to make more money and how to, as the title of that famous book was, Win Friends and Influence People. And how often are we in our own practice about giving answers to people instead of listening and enabling them to reveal themselves to us so that we in turn can understand the revelation of Jesus' presence?
I think that's exactly right. And it's a mystery of grace, really, that Luke sort of has gone about, I think, bringing that to attention, because having sort of that revelatory moment, and the story tells us it's dark, like it's the end, that's when they've gone in for the meal, but they decide they go back to Jerusalem.
Yes, yes.
And so they do. So whatever they were frightened of that caused them to leave, whatever they were distressed about, has gone, and they return, and when they get back there, They found the 11 and their companions gathered together. And what do they hear? Someone says, the Lord has risen.
Mm.
Indeed. And someone else says, he's appeared to Simon.
Mm.
So this is supposed to be Easter Sunday.
Mm.
You know, like the risen Lord is all over the place. Mm. Pretty busy.
Yeah.
And so then they tell their story.
Mm.
And that's what happens in a peer support group.
Mm.
The group comes together not because there's a facilitator who knows everything there is to know and gives everybody a chance to speak.
Mm.
They're there together because everybody knows a bit of the truth of their own experience, and the challenge is to sort of share that story. So everybody tells their bit, this is what happened to me, this is what happened to me. And in our congregation, that's the method we use mostly now for Bible study.
Mm.
So somebody might tell a story, text might be read, but the invitation is, where did that connect with you?
Mm.
And the group listens to everybody, and at the end there might be some summing up about what's been common, but that will come from the group as well. It's not like somebody's sort of posits that from outside.
Mm.
And the typical response from within the congregation after all of that is how enlivening and how empowering it is to hear these different stories, but that even though they were different experiences, they had the same spirit.
Mm.
And that spirit of grace has a dimension of solidarity which is far and transcends what a political understanding of solidarity would suggest. It's not about the solidarity of all believing the same thing. It's the solidarity of sharing the same truth.
Mm.
And it's a deeper reality and a more powerful reality. And I think that the gospel invites us, and I think in the work that we've done with research into the finance industry, that we've been trying to put that into words. How can we help people who are struggling with their work to come together in a way that allows them to speak about their experience and to learn from each other, that they're not mad if they're opposing injustice. They're not crazy if they're standing up to sort of the dictates of profit making and abusing clients. It can get you into trouble, it can cause all sorts of difficulty, but the opportunity to be in solidarity with other workers is denied in most workplaces.
Yes.
Or in many workplaces. Staff don't get an opportunity to talk about the injustices that they're experiencing in their workplace.
Mm.
One of the saddest stories of recent times was a woman wanted to talk to me about working in a healthcare setting. She'd gone there because she was drawn to the good work that they do and was completely shattered by the abuse that she suffered at the hands of the professional social workers in that agency.
Mm.
And without understanding what is going on there, that sort of points to how alienating it is if you go to work with an expectation that this is the job that I've been looking for.
Mm.
And what you encounter is violence.
Mm.
What you encounter is empire building and manipulation of stories and so on for the benefit of somebody higher up in the hierarchy.
Mm.
And that's, I think, too often today, the cause of mental illness and family relationship breakdown. The good news in this story is that when people come together and share these experiences, there is a gift of Christ's presence, and it's in the breaking of bread, which is a metaphor at this point, or it can be a metaphor for the sharing of brokenheartedness.
Yes. So I'm wondering, does the church's retreat from the world of work speak to its fear of an alleged body of knowledge, an alleged expertise that is contained within economic ideology and which purports to know the best and indeed the necessary method for social and economic and industrial organization? But is it also a symptom of the church's participation in a separation of human life into separate spheres of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The world of public knowledge, which captures the world of work, and the world of private knowledge, which is regarded as the world of personal belief or the world of personal morals or the world of personal ethics, etc. And how, given our own research, has demonstrated that much of the source of harm to employees arises from the violence that is done to the sense of personal ethic that they bring to their work. How can the church use that to bring together those separate realms of personal and private, and overcome the alleged expertise which is wielded by economic ideology?
I think the church, both because it's been pushed into the private space over 200 years and has been now complicit in occupying that space for that length of time. So the response of the Enlightenment or modernity to create that dualism between private and public has led to the church being primarily in that private space. So even when it takes up a public position, it tends to be doing it out of what it knows of the world through its engagement with the private sphere. So while I think it's important to start at both ends as much as possible, I think the priority for the congregation or the church as a worshipping community is to be a school of transformation or reformation. So that I take it as given that I'm formed fundamentally as a private man, that my masculinity is a reflection of traditional patriarchy, and that I've come to see the limits of that and to look for ways to be called out of that. And I think that the congregation is one place which I think can be a place where a safe environment is created for people to talk about the inner struggles of their life in a non-judgmental and accepting environment, so that so what we've done as a congregation, we've done that over 3 or 4 years now through the pandemic. And every time we have a process that focuses on that transformative or reformative conversation, I take the time to write, get that written up. So we write up the stories of people. So we published in lockdown with the Galatians as a pandemic response. We've got a current one about to be launched on community mental health support. So how does the congregation talk about mental health? And when we've talked about it and moved through that, we can then speak it into the public sphere as a public document. This is now part of a public debate.
We've
got Stephen Duckett has written a foreword or an introduction, and a leading mental health practitioner, lived experience, both writing things at the beginning to sort of say, these are private, if you like, experiences that people are putting into the public domain, because in the end, mental health is a public issue. And the fact that we've allowed it to be separated into a pathologizing, victim-blaming sort of experience is a travesty. It's against, it's antithetical to the gospel. So here we are as Christians, we're speaking about our experience, we're talking about it in biblical perspective, and now we want to speak that sort of truth into the public arena. So the church has to be much more, I'll say, sounding like Malcolm Turnbull, but much more agile in speaking from our given ground in the private sphere of people's lives into the public arena of work and politics and economics. We've got a truth to speak, but we need a process that takes us beyond that so that we start to live in the public sphere. The private sphere is always going to be important for the church as a place of relearning or reformation, because the world is actually brutal. I don't expect anybody to go cheering, oh, this is really great stuff. And you can expect scorn and whatever. So to have that sort of foundation within a congregation that's, that knows that its life depends on God's grace and forgiveness is just a power beyond words, if you like, that we've got to bring to this.
So preaching on this passage and speaking this passage into the world of work, what do preachers need to zero in on?
I think they need to really preach with a confessional voice about this, about their experience of violation, where they've experienced that. So they have to start with the journey out of Jerusalem. They have to start with how their lives have been affected by that experience of the world in its demonic, its cruelty, its violence, and then trace the journey. This is not sort of a click, click, you know, Jesus is here and it's all fixed. There's this transition here of not seeing, but when the moment comes, they can look back on the story and see that Christ was with them in the journey. Were not our hearts warmed or inflamed by what he was talking about? And then weren't our eyes opened? So this is open-hearted, opened eyes, opened ears, all these things that a preacher can tell stories about, so that people can understand that this story can be their story and their story can be this story. There's an interaction here. And it brings to a point of really of affirmation and proclamation. And how does the preacher help the congregation to come to a place in the life of their congregation, in the life of their church, where they can talk to each other about where they have discovered Christ's saving presence in their life? Have they ever talked about it with anybody in their church? It's important that they do. So the point I'm making is, unfortunately, the setup of our liturgy reinforces the individualism of the congregation and the minister. It separates. We've all got our own story. This is not, it's not about having our own story as an individual thing. It's about having our own story as a truth to be shared.
Well, I think on that point we can draw our discussion for today to a close. In our next episode, we'll look at readings from the 4th and 5th Sundays of the Easter season. But for now, John, as always, thank you for your company today.
Thanks as always, Brendan. Very good to be here again.
And if any of our listeners would like to leave any comments, suggestions or feedback, please go to the podcast website at www.workingthelectionary.podbean.com. Working the Lectionary is available on Podbean, the hosting service for this podcast, but it is now also available through Google Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio. In the meantime, John and I look forward to your company for the next episode. Goodbye for now.
This has been Working the Lectionary, examining the world of work through the readings of the weekly lectionary.